WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
It's that time of year when critics are busy making lists. Our film critic Stephen Schiff is joining us with his lists of the 10 best and 10 worst films of 1988. We're going to talk about some of those films, but first, we'll let Stephen count down his picks for the 10 best films of the year.
Starting with number 10, Hairspray. Number 9, Bird. 8, Beetlejuice. 7, Tequila Sunrise. 6, Wings of Desire, but I only admit the first half. 5, Hotel Terminus, The Life and Times of Klaus Barbie. 4, Dead Ringers. 3, Bull Durham. 2, A Cry in the Dark. And number 1, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown.
What was so good about Women on the Verge that made it all the way to the top of the list?
Well, for me, it was, for one thing, an almost perfect movie. Just delightful from the moment it opened to the moment it ended. And funny and original and beautiful to look at. Strange, funny to look at. A movie like nothing you've ever seen, and yet with hints of sort of decades of pop culture sort of seeping into it. It's about women and loss, but it's done with so much love for women by Almodovar, the director Pedro Almodovar, that its sentiment sort of becomes hip, and that's something that's very new in movies and something that we've lost. I mean, we need a little bit of sentiment in movies. We need a little bit of feeling, and to make it seem hip again, to feel that kind of. Stormy, Sturm und Drang kind of emotion is quite an achievement.
Now, Almodovar is a Spanish film director. Two of the other directors on your list are also foreign. Hotel Terminus by a French director,
Marcel Ophuls.
And Wings of Desire by the German director Wim Wenders.
That's right.
Is three a typical number for you of foreign directors that make it to the top 10 list?
Well, I think it varies a lot. There happen to be a lot of good American films this year, an unusual number of good American films. And I think that something is happening in Hollywood at the moment. I think that there's a kind of propensity by the studios, of all people, to look at an adult audience, to look at what might once have been an art film audience, and to welcome them back into the fold. And I feel that the sort of tendency for repetition and redundancy among the teenage films of the last 10 years is sort of being swept aside. There have been hints over the last few years that movies that a more adult audience could appreciate, some of them fairly lousy, I thought Fatal Attraction was fairly lousy, and Jagged Edge, could be hits. And when you get a ball like that rolling, it's liable to produce much, much better movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's time for your 10 worst list. Before you read the list to us, how does a film qualify for one of your 10 worst?
Well, you know, I mean, there are a lot of really bad movies every year. I mean, it's no good sort of knocking again a film like Cocktail or a film like Vibes or a film like Halloween Part, whatever it was this year. I mean, it's just too easy. To make my 10 worst list, a film has to really have made a nuisance of itself. It has to have been acclaimed.
It has to have ambitions.
It has to have ambitions. It has to have been acclaimed by a lot of people. It has to have taken a lot of people for a ride. It has to have met with some success. People have to have taken it seriously. I wish to disabuse them of that notion.
Let me point out, some of our listeners will think this is a rather perverse way of doing a 10 worst list. Last year, your number one worst film of the year was Fatal Attraction, which made it to number one probably on a lot of 10 best lists.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true.
Okay, here we go with the 10 worst.
All right. Number 10, Gorillas in the Mist. Number 9, Midnight Run. Number 8, Mystic Pizza. Number 7, Punchline. Number 6, U2, Rattle and Hum. Number 5, School Days. Number 4, Crossing Delancey. Number 3, Coming to America. Number 2, Mississippi Burning. And number 1, the worst film of 1988, Willow.
You know, I never even got around to seeing Willow, and for the life of me, I can't even remember what it was.
Well, Willow was that George Lucas fantasy that had little trolls and little strange creatures running around, and oh my, it was a real botch.
Mississippi Burning is an example of a film I've already seen on several 10 best lists.
Oh, Mississippi Burning will, I hereby predict, win the Best Picture Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was just a ghastly film. I think it's I don't think we really need yet another film that reduces the civil rights struggle, which is maybe the bravest social movement of the last three decades, to a war between the nice white people and the mean white people, and with the blacks in the background sort of as victims and little scared people running away. I mean, that is really not what it was about, and it's a terrible betrayal.
Would you run down for us your choices for five best actors and actresses of the year?
Yep. The Best Actor Awards. In
the envelope, please.
Yeah, exactly. In fifth place, Bill Murray for Scrooged. In fourth place, Tom Hanks for Punchline and Big. In third, Michael Keaton for Beetlejuice and Clean and Sober. Second, Jeremy Irons in Dead Ringers. And first, Dennis Quaid in a terrible movie, Everybody's All-American.
Let me just ask you about Dennis Quaid. You know, it's the kind of performance that you think, in a way, is gunning for an Academy Award because it spans decades and he has certain prosthetic devices to show himself aging. Do you think the performance transcended all of that?
Yeah, I do, because I thought, with all that going on, it was nevertheless extremely deeply felt, mm-hmm. beautifully observed. You know, there are a lot of sort of showboaty performances out there. Dustin Hoffman comes to mind in Rain Man, where a good deal of what's going on is a kind of actor's stunt. Even Jeremy Irons playing two people in Dead Ringers. But I think it's just as mistaken to dismiss it as a stunt when there's a lot more going on mm-hmm. as it is to sort of worship a stunt in which nothing is going on besides the stunt. And I think Dennis Quaid's performance was really admirable.
And the five best actresses?
Number five, Carmen Mora in Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Number four, Meryl Streep in A Cry in the Dark. Three, Diane Keaton in The Good Mother. Number two, Judy Davis in High Tide. And number one, Bette Midler in Big Business and Beaches.
Both of which you didn't like very much, right?
Yeah, I dislike both of those movies intensely, but I thought, you know, the sort of the bounty that is Bette Midler on the screen was overwhelming and great fun, and I mean, Beaches was just a disastrously terrible movie, but her presence in it somehow made it watchable, much as Dennis Quaid's in Everybody's All-American, another quite terrible movie.
You know, some of Meryl Streep's fans seem to be turning on her now. She's now being considered by people who once liked her a lot as relying too much on accents and exterior in her performances.
Well, this addresses the something we were talking about before, where the stunt that goes into a performance like that becomes the only thing in people's mind when actually there's a great deal else going on and the stunt is the vehicle. You know, I mean, when this kind of thing was being pioneered in the early 70s with, and in the late 70s, it really peaked with Robert De Niro's performance in Raging Bull. But before that, with Marlon Brando in The Godfather, this sort of absolutely meticulous, detailed impersonation where you change your body and you change your voice and you change your weight. And I think people do get kind of impatient with it. At the same time, Meryl Streep's performance in A Cry in the Dark is much more than her mastery of the Aussie accent. It is, I think, her best performance to date. It is completely uncompromising. It is absolutely chilling in its willingness to be unsympathetic, to be as cold and strange as the woman she portrays actually was, and to earn the tears that movie, I think, does earn the hard way by actually making you sympathize for an entire human condition instead of for someone who's cute or nice or likable or fetching in some way.
One more quick question, and then we'll have to wrap up. You've just presented several of your lists wrapping up the year. Do you like this time of year when you have to sit down and make 10 best and 10 worst lists?
Well, you know, this almost becomes an art form of a very, very, very minor sort. What would it be like? Like, a seashell sculpture or, some kind of really, lower form of macrame. But when you're forming these lists, you do kind of create an aesthetic effect, at least, you know, I feel that you do, almost the way a trailer does in a movie. It has a kind of concentration of all your experiences at the movies. It gives off this kind of rapid-fire blur, this kind of spray of feeling and memory that makes it more fun than it ought to be. I mean, doing that list is really beneath us all and is nevertheless a guilty pleasure that I take.
Well, Stephen, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Thanks for being with us.
Bye.
Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff. Here's music composed by Danny Elfman for the film Beetlejuice. This is Fresh Air.